It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The recent decisions by grand juries not to press charges against white police officers involved in fatalities involving black men in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York has led the headlines in recent weeks. These incidents have called into question the difficulty of charging police officers with crimes, even with video evidence, and what alternatives there could be to address police misconduct. Pitt Law Professor David Harris joins us for a discussion on the difficulty involved in charging officers and changing police departments. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm well, Paul. Good to be with you again.
It's been an eventful last few weeks.
Yes, it has.
Certainly the news from New York yesterday has not served to quell the conversation. It has certainly inspired people to discuss this issue, to react, to protest the grand jury's decision not to bring charges against the officer in New York, which was similar to what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. Why is it difficult to charge a police officer with a crime? And even if an officer is charged, why is it so difficult to convict?
Well, that's a great place to start the conversation. We have to understand first that police officers have a privilege, even a duty sometimes, to use force in a way that civilians just don't. So police officers, in a case like this, the question isn't did you do it and did you have a right to self-defense? It's how much force did you use and was it excessive? And that is a far different question than figuring out whether you used any at all. So that's the first hurdle. The second one is that police are entitled to use as much force as is reasonably necessary to carry out their jobs. And you can hear just from the way those words are that that's a very open-ended, very flexible standard that isn't – it's not a bright line rule. So because of those two things alone, it's hard to bring charges against police if there is any evidence that squares up with the idea that they felt threatened. If there is any evidence that they had a reasonable fear that they were going to have force used on them, the grand jury, tends to give them the benefit of the doubt. And they are entitled to that under the law because they have the privilege to use force. Once you get to the point of whether or not to bring charges, even say we do bring charges in any given case, there are difficulties ahead in convicting a police officer because a police officer comes into a courtroom, any courtroom, with a presumption of being the good guy. Oftentimes the people who are our witnesses in the case, they may have checkered past, not always, but sometimes they may have things in their past. They may not make good witnesses. And then the prosecutor has to carry the burden of proof on the state level of showing not just that force was used, but that force was excessive. And perhaps if it's a reckless-oriented crime, that it was reckless as well. And if you go to the federal level, there's an additional burden of proof. Beyond just proving excessive force, a federal prosecutor will also have to prove that the excessive force was used with the intention of depriving the victim of his or her federal constitutional rights. This makes these convictions extremely hard to get.
So much of this is about what the officer's mindset is.
Absolutely.
In that moment.
Yes.
Whether there was an intent to use excessive force, for whatever reason, to bring an excessive amount of force against an individual, and in the case of whether there's prejudice involved, you have to know also what kind of prejudice the officer is carrying in his mind as well. And that also, I'm guessing, is difficult to prove.
Difficult to prove. And remember, what you're looking at is, was the force used reasonable in relation to the circumstances the officer
faced?
Well,
and that again, is why so many people have an issue with what happened in New York. You had video evidence.
Yes.
Of a man who was committing a crime that I'm guessing would be classified – selling cigarettes openly in a manner that they couldn't be taxed, so you're denying revenue to the state. I'm guessing that's a misdemeanor.
It's certainly no more than a misdemeanor.
So, okay. So it's not a serious crime. He is unarmed. He, based on the video that we saw, did not appear to be a threat to anybody. And he's saying, as he's being put in the chokehold, "I can't breathe." And he's saying it multiple times. And it's on video. So with all of that evidence, especially with it being, you know, on video, people can see what happened. Why wouldn't that lead to a different outcome than what happened in Ferguson, where there was – no video, where so much was in dispute and it was
yes.
the word of certain witnesses against other witnesses and the word of the officer involved.
Yes. Remember that the law doesn't change just because there's video. So the same standards will apply as far as reasonable force. Did the officer follow his or her training? Did the officer intend to inflict some kind of harm or cause death? All of those questions remain exactly the same. The thing that differs with the video is that we have an indisputable record. So all of the issues that crop up when we charge police with crimes, or when we try to, the biases of the grand jury perhaps, and the sort of benefit of the doubt, and the way that the law is really set up to give police the benefit of the doubt with that reasonableness standard, that stuff is all the same. What differs is that you have a record, and therefore the facts are not disputed the same way. It doesn't mean that the outcome is going to be different, because the system and the laws are still the same. So if you notice, we still don't have agreement about what happened in Ferguson. There are plenty of people arguing, no, he had his hands up. Yes, he had his hands up. He was coming toward him. No, he wasn't.
But there's no video of
There's
that.
No video. Exactly. In New York, there's no dispute about the facts of what happened, or at least very little dispute. So it gives us that. It does not change the fundamentals involved in charging or not charging a police officer. That's what people have to understand, I think.
What about, though, one point that people keep coming back to, and it's a very legitimate point, or would seem to be, and that is that the police in New York have banned
rules.
Mm-hmm. They have made a rule that prohibits the use of the chokehold, and yet the chokehold was used and it led to the death of Eric Garner. CBS News legal analyst Ebony Williams noted that while the chokehold itself was against New York Police Department policy, it was not illegal per se. How is that possible?
Well, I think she's actually looking at the wrong thing. You can have police department rules that are more protective or do more than the law itself. So she's right about that. But what she's wrong about, or doesn't really address, is that the term chokehold is generic. There are two types of neck holds or neck restraints. One of them is when it goes directly across the windpipe, even seeks to crush the windpipe. The other is a hold from the sides of the neck that is supposed to impinge on the blood flow and make a person pass out.
Now, the sleeper hold.
Exactly, the sleeper hold. Now, my understanding is that the first one of those is against the rules, but the second one is actually not. And the officers are still trained to use the sleeper hold, which is not considered by the NYPD to be a chokehold. So what you have is a rule that people know about, but it isn't quite the rule they think it is. So the officer may not have violated policy or training at all, despite what we see and what we think from the reports in the media.
Let's have a conversation about this. If you would like to join our program and be a part of our discussion with University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002 for your comments and questions. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh, hashtag EPLive. Again, the number, 412-246-2002. Lots of questions here that are not easy to answer. as we parse through how the legal system works with regard to all this. I want to go back to grand juries. We talked earlier, you were with us on the program, and we talked about the history of grand juries.
Yes.
The whole system began in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain. So it is a holdover from the colonial days in the United States. We still have it now, but wasn't the whole point of the revolution in establishing a new constitution about breaking away from these things that are done in secret, which is how grand juries operate? Isn't our system of justice more based on sunshine and in a process that is open and that people can have access to?
It's a great point. It really is. And we are used to having an open court system for the very largest part. And so you ask yourself, how can it be that we still have a procedure that is almost entirely secret, that allows for not both sides, but just one side really to be heard?
And is it adding to the problem? Because people are reacting, people are protesting violently, and they are upset. Is it partly because they don't really know what happened? All they know is charges are not being brought, and we don't know what was said exactly. There are no transcripts, at least from New York.
Yes. It is partly because of that. Now, the reason that it exists historically, even though the revolution was about breaking away from English procedures, is because at that time the grand jury was viewed not as a government tool to investigate, but as a shield against the government and especially against the power of the crown. That's how it was used. It was used to shield people from government power and criminal and prosecutorial overreaching by the authorities, which is what they did regularly in England with the criminal process. So what it did was it was preserved in colonial times under the Constitution in the Seventh Amendment precisely to guard against government overreach. It's not until the 20th century that we have this secretive and powerful institution that becomes a main investigative tool for the federal government and even from the states.
Let's take a call, starting with Matt, who is driving to West Virginia. Matt, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Be safe. Hi, Matt.
How you doing?
Good. Thank you.
I just was curious.
Well, we lost you there, Matt. Hello, Matt? Matt going once, and we've lost him. Maybe we can get him back. I do understand that he was going to ask, according to what we have on the screen here, when a police officer is under scrutiny, why is their testimony given any weight at all? So, and that would be especially in the case in Ferguson regarding Darren Wilson.
Sure.
Why would his word about what happened be given as much weight as it was evidently given because, as Matt says, he was under scrutiny?
Yeah, this is a good question because we always in the justice system, whether criminal or civil, a person gets up to give testimony and we always say that person's credibility is on the line. The jurors are supposed to assess that person's credibility. And the more a person has to lose or gain by what they are saying, the more scrutiny we would think that we would give them. So it is a good point that Officer Wilson, for example, when he testifies in front of the grand jury, you would think his testimony would get scrutinized very, very minutely. And maybe some of the grand jurors did that. We just don't know. But what we do know, because the documents that were released, is that the prosecutors did not take any kind of skeptical view of anything he said. They didn't cross-examine him at all. In fact, they seemed to be helping him through his testimony and bolstering it. And that, I think, really does trouble people.
And that's because the prosecutor in that case and other prosecutors have – they need the cooperation of the police and they don't want to alienate them by – you know, that the perception is by putting too much pressure on in the line of questioning to somebody like Darren Wilson or Officer Pantaleo, as was the case in New York. Thank you so much for that question, Matt. 412-246-2002, the number to call. 412-246-2002 to join our conversation with David Harris as we look at these recent decisions by the grand juries and why they happen and what should happen going forward. Cameron McLay, who has just been confirmed as Pittsburgh's new police chief, says he wants to outfit all officers with body cameras. I want to get into some of the issues and the ideas with body cameras and whether they really are the panacea that some people believe they are. But first, we have Ben in McKees Rocks who wanted to jump in with a question. Ben, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hello. I've watched that film several times, and I've noticed something in the film that's being overlooked. There are two officers behind the officer who is applying the sleeper hold. That sleeper hold would not have killed Eric Gardner. However,
well, it was a choke hold is actually what he's applying.
Well,
right,
the choke
David?
Hold. That would not have killed Eric Gardner. There are two officers behind him, behind the one officer who's doing the hold. They're pressing their full weight on his back as he's laying on the sidewalk. This would expel the air from his lungs, creating a pressure on his chest and stop his heart from beating. I believe that is what killed him.
Well, that's that's a great point. And I believe in the medical examiner's evidence, those factors are part of what killed Eric Garner that are mentioned. They talk about his obesity, the weight bearing down on him from the other officers. Those were mentioned as contributing factors. The medical examiner found that the death was a homicide. And contrary to what people believe, homicide does not mean murder. Homicide means killed by another human being. The question is whether it's murder, whether it's justified or manslaughter. But all of these things were mentioned as contributing factors, but most prominently, the hold around the neck.
This maneuver takes a lot of practice and training.
Ben's,
that was a deliberate move. It's not something that happens spontaneously.
No, I don't disagree with you.
You're making the point that then, Ben, that it doesn't matter how Officer Pantaleo had held the man in New York, Eric Garner, that it had more to do with the other officers piling on.
They stopped his heart from beating through pressure on the chest against the sidewalk.
Again, I think it's important to mention that that was listed as a contributing factor. I think that's all that we can say at this point.
Now, that takes a coordinated effort. All five officers had to be involved in doing that because that's a maneuver that takes a lot of training to do.
So is what Ben is saying here, does that speak to the mindset that we were talking about earlier, that it really is at the core of deciding whether you charge the officer or not?
Well, it could be, because if Ben is right and this was a coordinated effort for which the people in the department had been trained, if I was a grand juror and I heard, look, I was just following my training, that would make me less inclined to indict. It would at best seem like a mistake, but a person following their training shouldn't be charged with a crime. So,
based on what Ben is saying,
yes.
Should the other officers have been potentially indicted?
No, and I think the reason again is because the weight put on to the gentleman and other things were only contributing factors. The main factor was the hold that cut off his breathing.
Let's go to Don in Edgewood. Don, you're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I guess I'd like to ask a question of the professor that has a little something in my mind more to do with the big picture than the minutia that we've been seeing in the news and on various fronts, and that has to do with the relevancy of certain sections of the Constitution, and I'm not by any means trying to trash the Constitution. It's been the foundation of our country for a very long time. But when I look at three specific issues, whether it be the rights dealing with gun ownership, and secondly, the free press, and thirdly, separation of church and state, and I guess more relevant to what you're discussing now, basic human rights, I question whether our Constitution has been able to keep up with the contemporary changes which have happened in our culture and in our society so that we can better address numerous things anywhere and more as our country appears to be headed toward the separation of classes with a wider gap taking place. It appears more and more like an oligarchy where the people that are in power and have a vested interest in remaining in power, and let me suggest that in this case, those people certainly would be behind the police in most cases, that plays so much into Supreme Court rulings as was illustrated with the Supreme Court decision related to the Koch brothers and the funding of campaigns.
All right, Don, let me jump in here because I think what you're asking here really is boiling it down to the essence of your question, which is why are civil rights violations by police so hard to prove?
Yeah, there's that, and I think we can take the question from the 30,000 foot view as well. I would just say to Don on his question about the relevance of the Constitution. It is incredibly relevant, but what a constitution does is it sets the floor for how the government must deal with our rights. So in other words, the pertinent piece of the Constitution in the Garner case and in the Ferguson, Michael Brown, Darren Wilson case is the Fourth Amendment, which says no unreasonable searches and seizures. And the way the Supreme Court has read that since time out of mind is an arrest or even worse, a taking of a life by the state, by the state's agent, is a seizure. So you measure those kinds of things under the Fourth Amendment's unreasonable seizures language. And it is very general. It says you can only use as much force as is reasonable and proportionate. And we were talking earlier about how general and flexible that is. But that does not mean that Congress and state legislatures cannot step in and give citizens more protection than the Constitution gives, because the Bill of Rights is a minimum standard. States can't take away anything below that, but they can give more. So, for instance, if we held our politicians accountable for something we wanted, such as a greater police accountability or whatever it happens to be, they can pass laws that give us more protection. So the Constitution, I think, endures because it's general. If we want our country to be successful and fair and include everybody, we have to have those political conversations as well.
Let's go to Scott in Clairton with a question. Scott, you're on Essential Pittsburgh with David Harris.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Going back to what your guest made the comment about old English law, it's my understanding that in a grand jury, a juror can actually question witnesses. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, and I could well be because I'm not on the
No, you're right. You are correct, Scott.
And a juror can actually request that the prosecutor move in a different direction and engage in different questions, if not a different investigation altogether. Is that not correct? And if so, why is it that when you're seated on a grand jury, you're specifically not informed of that?
Well, I don't know about the very last thing you asked, whether you're informed of that or not, but I do know that grand jurors are entitled to ask their own questions of witnesses and even to push prosecutors to bring in other evidence or other witnesses and so forth. The thing is, in the end, whether or not to do that is the decision not of the grand juror but the prosecutor. So the grand juror is left with the power to request, not require. And if the grand juror doesn't feel that there's enough evidence to constitute probable cause, the grand juror can vote no indictment. That's the power that the grand juror has.
An alternative to charging individuals is structural reform via the U.S. Department of Justice intervention as announced in Cleveland yesterday. What can you tell us about this, David?
Well, this is one of the newest and most effective ways, I think, of getting at this problem. You can imagine lots of other kinds of reforms. There's been a lot of talk about independent prosecutors for these cases. We had news just this morning that the New York State Attorney General was thinking about taking over all of these police prosecutions in his state. But one of the things that has developed over the last 20 years and which Pittsburgh was one of the first places to have used on it was so-called pattern or practice reform. This is a law that passed in 1994 by the Congress. It says if there is a pattern or practice, in other words, not one bad incident, but a pattern of constitutional violations, the Justice Department may step in, do a thorough investigation, and if necessary, sue in federal court to get an adjudication of that and then to have the judge impose changes. What usually happens is what happened in Pittsburgh.
We went through this in 1997.
That's right. And the Justice Department came in, did a thorough investigation, said the Pittsburgh Police Department has these deficiencies. We want you to change them in these ways. Since the city was willing or maybe not willing to go to court over it, they came to an agreement. This is called a consent decree, and a federal court supervised the changes in the Pittsburgh Police Department from 97 to 2002.
And what issues can be addressed?
Almost anything that you can think of that might violate the Constitution. So search and seizure problems, traffic stops, pedestrian stops, stop and frisk, complaint handling by the police department. This was a major factor in the Cleveland case that was announced just the other day.
Right.
Their complaint handling processes were not constitutionally adequate. So it can be a complete top-to-bottom makeover of how the police do their jobs and deal with the public if the Justice Department, ultimately enforced by a federal judge, concludes that there's a pattern of constitutional violations. Not one bad incident, but a pattern over a long time.
Does it work? Has it worked here?
It does work. It hasn't worked everywhere it's been done because we know that because in some places they've had to do it twice. In Cincinnati, that is probably the biggest victory there has been for this. 2001, 3 days of rioting. They came in. They did a consent decree. There were other reforms that were part of the package too, and they now have a much different relationship between the police and the citizens they serve. L.A., another very good example. Here in Pittsburgh, big changes were made also. The performance assessment and review system, the personnel system, the early warning system here in Pittsburgh, which was cutting edge when it was set up, that was a big, big change here. And so the question then is, we got to have the wherewithal to keep that system in place once the 5 years is over.
Let's take one last call from Leslie in Swissvale. Leslie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, hello. I just was going to comment that I've been concerned because I didn't see the video, but I know that from what I've heard in the Garner case, there didn't seem to be any threat to the police at all. There were several policemen there, and he didn't seem to be fighting back. He just wanted to breathe. And I just don't understand, you know, in the past, they tried to talk people down and, you know, even with terrorists and very severe things, they would try to get somebody to talk them down. And it just seems very very unjust to have someone die.
You're saying, Leslie, that not everything was done to prevent harm from coming to an individual, which ultimately is what critics are saying that the police need to be more focused on, is what can I do to scale down the potential for violence.
Yes, it's a great point, and there's a lot of discussion in law enforcement on this very thing. The idea is to de-escalate tension, not to ratchet it up, if at all possible, through verbally doing this, even physically doing this. You try to de-escalate, and I think you're going to find more police departments putting an emphasis on this now with this case behind us.
And we're going to talk more about this with Mayor Peduto tomorrow. But as I was saying earlier, Cameron McLay has been confirmed as of this morning as Pittsburgh's new police chief by the city council. The mayor wants the new police chief wants to outfit all officers with body cameras. Mayor Peduto wants Pittsburgh officers to be wearing those body cameras within 2 years instead of six. Yet we, with Eric Garner, in that case, have seen that video may not make a difference. So why would body cameras make any difference at all? Ultimately, why are they important?
Well, it's not a silver bullet. There's no technological fix that will cure all the ills that we have. But they are an important advance. There's just no doubt about that. They create a record. That is their main function, and a lot of the dispute is taken out of what happened. That can save police officers from complaints against them that are not correct. It can also collect evidence. It can also be a picture, a nuanced, really deep picture of police misconduct. It has that effect as well. And what it will really do, and this has been shown in all of the studies to date, is it has a civilizing effect on both sides of the camera. The public behaves better towards police officers who are recording, and police officers behave better towards the public when they are recording. So these things won't cure everything, but they can do a lot to improve the situation that we have now.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris sharing his insights. As always, David, great thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
Coming up, mining the data from all those likes and tweets isn't as easy to compile as it might seem. That's next here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.